us. Some of you would like to bring the gift of your man and all glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to the assembled devotees. All glorious to Sri Guru and Gauranga. All glorious to Sri Vishnupadaya Vishnupashaya Mutuashi Mati Bhakti Vinata Swami Jinamya Namaste Saraswati Deva Goravani Kuchani Namaste Sisampani Maskachari Sitamya Mandeham Shri Guru Shri Utah Padakamam Shri Guru Vaishnavam Shah Shri Rukam Sagraja Tam Sagamara Vena Tam Vitam Tam Sajiva Sagraitam Sagritam Jana Sagata Krishna Tantam Deva Shri Nara Krishna Padam Sagrana Amitashi Hare Krishna. It's the 13th of November 2016 at Jagannath Puri in Durban, South Africa. And we're going to be looking at a topic which I ended up putting together this presentation on sexual desire because of a Bhagavatam class that I gave in New Zealand. We have a quote from one of them, from that verse in this presentation. And afterwards, all the devotees said, "We really need to make this into a full-on seminar and teach this all over the world." So I hope that you'll find it edifying and useful. So this is based very much on the teachings of the founder Acharya of ISKCON, A.C. Bhaktivinoda Swami Prabhupada. So we're going to be looking at four different areas. What is the original spiritual bliss? How love turns into lust? How we go take it back again from lust into love? And how do we deal with our lust while we're turning it back into love? And so here Srila Prabhupada is saying this is his purport to the very first verse of the Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 1, Verse 1, where he says that sex life is not unreal, it has a real reality in the spiritual world. So this concept is at the root of our entire Gaudiya philosophy, that whatever we see in this world has some counterpart in the Supreme. Right? Even Prabhupada said, if you take pleasure in, you know, ghastly things, then what form of the Lord deals with really ghastly things? What form of the Lord does something really ghastly? The same day, pretty ghastly. Parsha's pretty ghastly too. And so whatever one wants to enjoy in this world, it has its original form somewhere in the Supreme. So in the Majjhima 8:138, and if you're interested in this topic, I would suggest that you go by yourself to that verse in purport. Krishna is called the original Cupid. And this particular verse in purport is about the Kama Gayatri Mantra. And these names for the Lord in the Kama Gayatri Mantra, Kamadei, Pushpavana, and Ananga, all refer to Cupid. So Krishna is all called by such names. And this is from that purport. Prabhupada says, in the material world, if one is sexually inclined and enjoys sex life, he enjoys something temporary. His enjoyment vanishes after a few minutes. However, in the spiritual world, the same enjoyment may be there, but it never vanishes. It is continuously enjoyed. In the spiritual world, such sex pleasure appears to the enjoyer to be more and more relishable with each new feature. In the material world, however, sex enjoyment becomes distasteful after a few minutes only and is never permanent. Because Krishna appears very much sexually inclined, he is called the new Cupid in the spiritual world. There is no material inebriety in such desire, however. Now, it's not only Krishna who's the original, spiritual, ever-fresh Cupid, but also we, the living entities, the jiva. And again, turning to that same purport, Srila Prabhupada says that this desire for enjoyment is present both in God and in us, but these desires are spiritual. By the way, what is the difference between a material and a spiritual desire? Does anyone know how Krishna Das Kaviraj distinguishes between a material and a spiritual desire? Yes?
A material desire stems from the mind. A spiritual desire stems from the consciousness.
Oh, I really like that. Material desires stem from the mind, and spiritual desires stem from the consciousness. Very nice. So the source is different. Anyone else like to offer some difference between the material and the spiritual desire? Yes? Yes, material as a beginning and an end. It's called samsparshaja. They're born from touch, and they have a beginning and end, and the spiritual goes on forever. Yes? Excellent. It's for Krishna's pleasure, it's spiritual, it's for our pleasure, it's material. Now that sounds really awful to us conditioned souls. It sounds like, well, if I do something for you, it's nice, and if I do it for me, it's not nice. But if we understand that we're part of Krishna, that would be just like saying, if my hand puts food in the stomach, that's good, and if my hand just rubs food on itself, that's bad. You know, that's like little babies don't usually get in their mouth, right? And the food's all over their face. And when my daughter was a baby, she used her hair like a napkin. You know, she'd eat something, and they eat a little, you know, and they put it all over their hair. So I have to give her a bath after every meal. So rubbing the food in your hair is bad, and putting the food in your mouth is good. So Prabhupada quotes this often from the Vedanta Sutra, Ananda Maya Sat, that the living entities have a spirit of pleasure. We are pleasure-seeking. And just like in the military, they have some missiles that are heat-seeking. You've heard of this, right? They're heat-seeking missiles. They shoot them and they can hone in on the heat from the engine of an airplane and blow up the plane. So we're like this with pleasure. We're always looking, right? Where is their enjoyment? Where is their enjoyment? And anything that looks like it's enjoyment, we go for that. So that's true of us also, not only just of Krishna. And this is from the next purport, 8139. The Prabhupada says, the living entities, moving and non-moving, are part and partial of Krishna. Therefore, they originally have the same kind of lusty desire as his. Now, this was the verse that started me on the journey of doing this seminar. This is from the Bhagavatam 525.5. And this is about some princesses that were massaging the body of Lord Balaram. And what Srila Prabhupada writes in this purport is, when males and females touch each other's bodies, their lusty desires naturally awaken. It appears from this verse that there are similar sensations in spiritual bodies. All sensations originally exist in the spiritual body. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur has commented in this connection that the word adi, which means beginning literally, means adi rasa, the original lusty feeling, which is born from the Supreme. However, spiritual lust and material lust are as completely different as gold and iron. So gold and iron are both metal, but they're entirely different. You probably wouldn't wear iron jewelry, right? If your daughter's getting married, you're not going to buy a bunch of iron jewelry. And you're not going to cook out of a gold pot, right? So they're very different.
They say that you become desireless. No, that is not true. How can I? If I become desireless, I become dead. So long I am living entity, I must be there. I cannot check it.
So because these desires for enjoyment are part of the soul, they cannot be killed. They cannot be killed. So here we have, this is a picture of a plant and a piece of iron. Right? What is the difference between something alive and something that's dead? Something that alive is full of desire. It's one of the main symptoms of life. Right? We hear, I think, therefore I am. But I don't believe that the plants do a whole lot of thinking. But they do have desires. All living beings have desire. Because this desire for pleasure is part of the soul, trying to kill that desire will not work. This is from the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. Prabhupada says, actually, lust and the sex urge are there in spiritual life. But when the spirit soul is embodied in material elements, that spiritual urge is expressed through the material body and is therefore pervertedly reflected. One who actually becomes conversant with the science of Krishna consciousness can understand that his material desire for sex is abominable, whereas spiritual sex is desirable. So we can't kill something that has its origin in something spiritual that's part of us. It's not possible. We can become disgusted with the material sexual desire, but if we try to kill the desire completely, we will fail because it is ultimately a spiritual
desire. The killing of the human society is criminal. It is not unnatural because the same sex feeling is there in the original personality of God. The pleasure potency is Srimati Radharani. That feeling, the attraction of sex or loving at death on the basis of sex feeling is the original feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And we, the conditioned souls, being the part of partial of the Supreme, we have got such feelings. But they are in a perverted, minute condition.
So again, Prabhupada's making the same point. These feelings come from something in the soul itself. So what happens when we try to kill sexuality? And I think we need to make this point very clearly, because such a mistaken effort is done by people trying to become spiritual. They think, all right, let me just try to destroy or kill my sexual desires. So there's usually three different results from that attempt. One will be anger. Anger is called kama anujena, or the younger brother of lust. If you try to kill anger, you simply kill lust, you may simply transform it into anger. And we sometimes see this, that people who are taking up a spiritual discipline in the wrong way by trying to kill their sexuality become very angry people. And it's a phenomenon that we notice in any kind of religious or spiritual group that understands the danger of material sexuality. So it's a problem that we've had in our International Society for Krishna Consciousness. And we sometimes see members of our society whose main mode of being is anger. That the main way they're dealing with others is anger. And there's a number of possible causes for that, but this is very high on the list. Another possible result of trying to kill one's sexuality and sexual desires is to get a hard heart. Because if you try to kill something, you just kind of kill everything. It's sort of like, you know, you turn off the whole power to the building when you're trying to turn off one light. And so the person's heart becomes hardened. They become callous, they become unfeeling, and they become disinterested in everything. Many times people think that equilibrium and being equipoise means I don't know and I don't care. Actually, the great devotees both know and care. One devotee said to me recently, He said, people ask me why, if I'm living in Vrindavan, I care about what are the events of the world. He said, well, Advaita Acharya also cared about the events of the world. And he was praying for Lord Chaitanya to appear. And I thought, that is such a beautiful expression. We don't care about the things of the world because we think on the material level we're going to be a reformer. But we care about the things of the world because we have compassion. Compassion means I know and I care, but I don't lose my own joy. I don't lose my own peace. I keep my own peace and I keep my own joy, even though I know and care. Rupa Goswami explains that for the devotee to attain love of God, the heart has to melt completely. And it has to be in a state where it melts very easily, just like butter. But if one tries to kill all of their sexuality and sex desire, they will have the opposite. They will end up with a rock-hard heart. Of course, it's very difficult for the heart to stay hard. That's not the general nature of the living entity. And so a person may vacillate between being callous and being angry. Another possibility is fall down. So a person ends up engaging in some sort of degraded or illicit or whatever sexual behavior. So they're trying to repress and kill, repress and kill, repress and kill, repress and kill. And then when it does come out, it comes out in a way that's not even pious or moral. And a person may cycle between these three. They may cycle between engaging in improper sexual behavior, in being callous, and in being angry. And this anger can be directed in general, or it can be directed particularly against their sex object. So, you know, men who hate women, often this is because they're simply trying to kill their sexual feelings. So this is not the way. This is not how we're going to deal with our mundane sexuality. So how should we deal with it? Well, again, we'd already mentioned that adiras means the original sexual pleasure and sexual feeling that's there in the Lord. And we know that the Lord experiences this adirasa with the bliss of his own potency, with the Ladini potency. Actually, Radha and Krishna are one. They're one person. They're not really two persons. But for the sake of pleasure pastimes, they eternally appear as two persons. All right, so we all understand that, yes? Everybody understands that God, to be complete, must be both masculine and feminine, and the love between the Lord in his two features is the adiras, or the origin of sexual desire and sexual feeling. But, all right, how does that translate to our situation? Well, again, for Krishna, Radharani embodies the potency of ecstasy. She is the only source of enjoyment for Krishna. But again, she is himself. Yes? Radha and Krishna are the same. So this original union of joy and love is there between Radha and Krishna. So what does that mean for us? In Madhulila 8.158, the same section, Prabhupada writes, the pleasure relished by Krishna's pure devotees is also manifested by his pleasure potency. So the liberated souls, the enlightened souls, the pure devotees, the spiritual happiness we're getting, when we say, oh, I'm in bliss, oh, I'm in ecstasy, what does that mean? It means it's a pleasure coming from this same Ladini potency that's giving pleasure to Krishna. In CC 460, the Ladini pleasure gives energy, gives Krishna pleasure, and it nourishes his devotees. How does that work, though? As Prabhupada explains in this one lecture, devotees, as soon as they see smiling Krishna, pleasing Krishna, they become pleased. They become pleased by seeing Krishna pleased. They do not want to be pleased independently. That is not devotee. Devotee's pleasure is seeing Krishna is pleased. Krishna is also pleased when he sees the devotees are pleased. So Krishna is not like some kind of dictatorial, exploitive ruler. In the history of the world, we have had many, many times cruel and exploitive leaders in business and in government who say, work for me, make me happy, and I don't care about you. This is going on even today. There's so many businesses, they go to some country where there's no protection for the workers. They can make their products cheaply there. They use all kinds of harmful chemicals which damage the health of the workers. And when the workers' health is damaged, they say, all right, too bad, now you're fired, take care of yourself, correct? Right? They say, you're working for my happiness and my profit, and I don't care about you. Krishna's not like that, because Krishna's happiness is in pleasing his devotees. It's a general mood of my happiness is coming from giving pleasure. So we, the living entities, experience the pleasure of this adiras when we want to please Krishna. Because as soon as we want to please Krishna, Krishna also wants to please us. Here Prabhupada said that our movement is for approaching Radha Krishna to be associated with the Supreme Lord in his sublime pleasure dance. That is the aim of Krishna consciousness. Now, a quote like this might make you think that all of us are meant to be in the madhurya or conjugal rasa with Krishna. That's not a fact. We all have our original position. But the point is that we are meant to assist the Lord in his own pleasure potency. Here again, Prabhupada's making the same point. This is some perfect questions, perfect answers. We get our spiritual pleasure from trying to please Krishna. When we please the Lord, we experience this adiras whenever we please the Lord. When we say, please the Lord, what we mean by that is I'm taking the Lord and his pleasure energy and I'm putting them together. That's what it means. The Lord has his energy of pleasure. When I put him with his pleasure energy, I am pleasing him. Do you all follow the logic of that? Here Bhaktivinoda writes, as I go to draw water from the Jamuna, I shall cherish knowing the confidential mellows that unite the divine pair, Radha and Krishna. So he's saying the jiva experiences this happiness when Krishna is pleased, when Radha and Krishna come together. Talked about this briefly in the Manashiksha seminars, but Bhaktisiddhanta Sarasvati says in his commentary to the Shikshastika on Anandam Buddhivardhanam, he says, we, the living entity, have an infinite capacity, have a finite capacity for pleasure, not an infinite capacity, right? And we all realize this? We have a very small capacity for pleasure. How many pieces of pizza can we eat? Right? But Krishna has an infinite capacity. When we are connected with Krishna, we enjoy, as Prabhupada says, through Krishna. What Krishna enjoys, we enjoy. Just like what my stomach enjoys, my brain, my hands, my skin also enjoy. The enjoyment of my eyes is the enjoyment of my whole self. So when the living entity is bringing together Krishna and his potency of pleasure, the living entity enjoys, along with Krishna, everything that Krishna is enjoying. Now this principle is true, as we said, not only for the devotees whose eternal spiritual form is one of Krishna's queens or one of Krishna's gopis. It's also true for the devotees of Narayana. They want to unite Lakshmi and Narayana, as Prabhupada writes in his purport to 1.5.32. We engage Lakshmi in the service of Lord Narayana, and then we become happy. This is even on a practical level in the this world if we use our opulence. Yes? What is all our opulence? Our opulence is all Lakshmi Devi. All our beauty, our wealth, our physical strength, our mental strength, our knowledge, our fame, our detachment. When we use that in the service of Narayan, then we experience the same happiness that Narayan experiences. This is true with all the incarnations. It's true for Hanuman. Right? Prabhupada says here in Bhagavad Gita 2.6, Hanuman fought for Lord Ramachandra. He did not fight for himself, not for his personal interests. The interest was how to get out Sitaji from the hands of Ravana and let her sit down on the side of Ramachandra. This is the policy of Hanuman, the devotees. Explains what the word Om means. As you probably know, in Sanskrit, we never put two vowels together. You're familiar with that? Any of you learned Sanskrit? Even in English, generally when we put two vowels together, they make a new sound, like cream. You don't say kre-em, right? E and A come together and make a new sound. It's hard to say one vowel after another. We have a few English words like that. Create, vacuum, skiing, India, a few. But in general, in the English language, whenever two vowels are next to each other, they make a new sound. But the sound they make in English does not come from the sound of those letters. It's just a different sound. The A of the E and the A of the A have nothing to do with the E of the cream. But in Sanskrit, it's not like that. The sounds of Sanskrit are in harmony with the mechanics of our physical body, because everything that Krishna creates is in harmony and is integrated together. So there's a sound A. Right? The sound A is made when you don't use your lips, your tongue, your teeth. Try that. A. Can you try that? So Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita says he is the sound of ah. Ah is the beginning sound. You can't make any sounds without the sound ah. Then there's the sound ooh. So Jiva Goswami says this sound ooh represents Srimati Radharani, represents the Lord's Ladini Shakti or pleasure potency. Now if you say ah and ooh, one right after another, you can try ah, ooh, ow, 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 ow. Get an O. So that's a Sanskrit letter O. As I said, it doesn't work like that in English, you know. You never get the E. That's where the O comes from. The sound in Sanskrit O is made up of the two sounds A and U. So A is Krishna. When Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita of letters, I'm the letter A, it looks to us like the English letter A, but it's not the letter A, it's the letter A. Totally confuse you if you weren't already confused enough. So the letter A, in Sanskrit, names and sounds of the letters are the same. You understand? You know, in English we have the sound of letter B, but it makes the sound B. In Sanskrit it's not like that. If there's a letter that makes the sound A, then the letter's name is also A. Makes sense. You have to learn two sets of things. Anyway, so this A and this U are the Lord in masculine form as A, and as in feminine form as U. And then the M of the Om, the Anushwar, is us, the Jivas, the living entities. So when you vibrate Om, you're bringing together the Supreme as masculine, the Supreme as feminine, and oneself. And this is why even the impersonalists get happiness, because they are also bringing together the Lord and his energy of pleasure. Okay, so this is the main way that we bring together the Lord and His pleasure energy, isn't it? Yes? The main way that we bring together the Lord and His pleasure energy, we take that sound down, is through the Hare Krishna mantra. Right? Hare is the feminine, and Krishna and Rama is the masculine. And when we are chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, the Lord and His internal potency are dancing on our tongue. Now, by the way, we only realize this if when we're chanting the Hare Krishna mantra, we're doing it with that intention. If we're chanting Omkar or the Hare Krishna mantra or Sita Ram, and we're just chanting it as something ritualistic, and our mind is elsewhere, then we may not experience much of anything. Prabhupada said then that's pretty useless, or it will take a very long time. But if while we're chanting, we're in meditation. Chanting is supposed to be a kind of meditation. So when we chant on our own, japa, when we have our group meditation in kirtan, what's supposed to happen in kirtan is everyone in the room is supposed to be fully focusing their energy on the mantra that they're chanting. And when you do that, we all carry each other. And if we're all fully focused, not just on the sound, but if we're fully focused on this feeling of affection in the heart, that there is the Lord and His internal energy dancing on my tongue and in my heart, then the experience for all of us is much greater than if we just chant on our own, which is why we say Sankirtan is the sacrifice for this age. It's something like when you have a picnic or a festival and everybody brings something to eat. So you only cook one preparation, but you get to eat 50 preparations. You understand? So if everybody contributes, then you get back much, much, much more than you put into it. You put into one preparation, you get back 50. So in a kirtan, it's like that. If everybody is really focused, if nobody's thinking, what am I going to do in an hour? You know, my foot hurts, or... If everyone's just absorbed in chanting the mantra, then we experience the union of the Lord and His pleasure energy, and we also will experience that adi-ras. All right, so we talked about how in the liberated state, in our original state, we, the living entity, are experiencing the origin of sexual pleasure and sexual union. How does that turn into the material sexuality? How does that spiritual love turn into lust? Well, we talked about Hanuman, how Hanuman is trying to unite Sita and Ram. So Ravana has the opposite policy. Prabhupada says here, this is a lecture from the Bhagavad Gita 2.6 and 73, Ravana's policy is take Sita away from the clutches of Ram and enjoy it. This is Ravana policy. And the Hanuman policy is take out Sita from the hands of Ravana and get her seated by the side of Ram, the same Sita. So this pleasure energy, as Lakshmi, as Sita, as Radharani, in the spiritual way of enjoyment, the jiva unites the Lord and His energy of pleasure. In the material way of enjoyment, we want to take the pleasure energy away from the Lord and enjoy that pleasure energy ourself independently. Does that work? No, it does not work very well at all. As soon as we try to take Sita away from Ram and enjoy her independently, who do we get? Do we get Sita? No, who do we get? No, if we try to be Ravana, and we try to take Sita away from Ram for ourselves, we don't get Sita. Who do we get? We get Maya, we get Durga. That's our problem. That's material lust. Spiritual adi-ras is I want to bring Sita to Ram. And when Sita and Ram are together, I experience their happiness. Material lust is I want to be Ravana. I want to take Sita away from Ram, and I want to enjoy her myself. I want to enjoy that pleasure energy independently of the Lord. This desire to take the pleasure energy away from the Lord and enjoy it independently is the root of all our material problems. I mean, you can think of this with a very simple material example. If I'm a guest in someone's house, they naturally share the things of their house with me as their guest, isn't it? They share their food with me, they share their furniture with me, they share their, you know, Wi-Fi with me. They share whatever is there to share, they share it with me. But if I say, oh, this is a very nice house, let me take the furniture, let me take the soap, let me take it for myself. So that's the difference. Okay? If I'm enjoying with somebody, I get to enjoy what they enjoy. But if I try to take it away from them, then I'm a criminal. And the police department, they'll not only take away from me what I stole, but they'll punish me for stealing. And the person who is so happy to have me as a guest in their house, they're not very happy if I steal their things. Isn't it interesting? The same person, they're happy to let me use their water, their electricity, their furniture. They'll say, here's a chair, you can sit in the chair. But if I say, okay, that's my chair, I'll take it, then they're not going to be happy. Same person, same chair. If I'm using it with them, they're happy. If I take it for myself, they're not. And neither would I be. Here we're looking again at the teachings of Lord Chaitanya. The material Cupid increases the attraction of the external flesh and body, but the spiritual Cupid increases the attraction the super soul exerts upon the individual soul. Actually, lust and the sex urge are there in spiritual life, but when the spirit soul is embodied in material elements, that spiritual urge is expressed through the material body and is therefore pervertedly reflected. One who actually becomes conversant with the science of Krishna consciousness can understand that his material desire for sex is abominable, whereas spiritual sex is desirable. So here Prabhupada is saying, in our original state, the attraction, the union, the pleasure is between the soul and the super soul. In material life, we think it's between the bodies. And Prabhupada says, when the spiritual urge is expressed through a body, it becomes nasty. But we shouldn't think that, well, the soul is wonderful and pure and full of pleasure, and we just have this raw deal of a body, you know, that God just gave us this body that makes everything nasty. It's not exactly like that. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 15:9, that we get a certain type of ear, eye, tongue, nose, and sense of touch grouped around the mind. In other words, we have a material body, my dear friends, because we want it. If we want to try to enjoy the energy of pleasure separately from the Lord, that's actually not possible. The Ladini Shakti belongs to the Lord. It cannot be enjoyed separately from the Lord. It just can't. Intrinsically, inherently, by definition, it cannot. So if we want something that's impossible, then we're given a body of illusion. We're given a world of illusion. And there we can express these false and impossible desires, which then come out in the way that we think about materially as sexuality. Now, one difficulty is that material sexuality, having come from the spiritual, may be hard to distinguish from the spiritual. And many people have this problem. They think their material sexual desires and activities are all really wonderful and beautiful and loving and which, I'm sorry, but they're not. But it's sometimes hard to distinguish. So here we have from the Krishna book, Prajumna is material Cupid. He's the son of Krishna. And it said, when the women saw Prajumna dressed in yellowish garments with very long arms, curling hair, beautiful reddish eyes, a smiling face, jewelry and ornaments, they at first could not recognize him as a personality different from Krishna. So we will often see our romantic attachments, subtle and gross in this world, and think, oh, they're so spiritual, because they come from the spiritual, and they may not be so distinguishable. Prabhupada goes on to say, Prajumna's personal appearance was exactly like Krishna's, and he was factually Cupid himself. Prajumna's bodily characteristics were so similar to Krishna's that he was mistaken for Krishna, even by his mother. Therefore, it's very easy for us in the material world to make this mistake of confusing our lust for love, of not being able to tell the difference. All right, so this is how our original spiritual love gets transformed into lust or material sexuality. How are we going to turn it back? How are we going to bring it back to its original? Remember, we can't kill it, right? Everybody remember we can't kill it? Don't try to kill it, friends. It's not killable. It's spiritual, it can be spiritual, it's eternal. It can't be killed. So how are we going to turn it back? What's our real cure? So here in the purport to 4.22.30, Srila Prabhupada says, our material desire for sense enjoyment is the cause of our fall down in this material world. However, if we turn our desires toward the transcendental loving service of the Lord, our desires become purified. We cannot kill desires. We've heard that before, yes? We have to purify them in different designations. If our desires are applied to the service of the Lord, they become purified, and thus we become immediately free from material contamination. I always find it interesting when Prabhupada uses words like immediately. It's telling us it's possible for it to be immediate.
Kama Krishna Paramatmane. At the present moment, we are desiring how to become happy in this material world. This is karma. So this brain taxation, if you engage in Krishna service, how to spread Krishna consciousness, how to convince people about Krishna, how to take them to the Krishna's desire, sarvadharma and parityaj.
So this principle that love is trying to please Krishna and lust is trying to take Krishna's pleasure potency away from Krishna, we fix it by trying to please Krishna again. And it's really simple. Prabhupada's using the word here, kama, which means lust. He's saying, how do we exhibit our lust in this world? We make so many plans. I'll become happy this way. I'll fulfill my desires in this way. I'll fulfill my desires. Make the same kind of plans to make Krishna happy. We should become absorbed in the real. So the first thing we mention is that we again try to please Krishna. We make plans to become Krishna conscious. We make plans to help other people become Krishna conscious. The next thing we can do to turn our lust back into love is we absorb ourselves in Krishna. Krishna says, Mam anusmam yujitcha. Right after, in 8.6, Krishna says to Arjuna, Yam yam bhavi smam bhavam, whatever you think about, you will become. He says, therefore, think about me while you fight. That's amazing. Think about me while you fight. I mean, I don't know, at least in this life, I have never been a warrior. But I can imagine it would be pretty hard to think of anything else while you fought except what you were doing. In fact, we know Arjuna was very one-pointed in his fighting, right? You all know that story? Jonacharya gave an exam to his students. In a real Gurukula, they don't give paper and pencil, fill in the little circle exams. That's not the ancient traditional system of education isn't like that. It's not that everybody sits down. No, the exam was, let's go outside, and I put a toy bird in the tree, and aim your arrow at the bird. So, you know, they get up, aim their arrow. What do you see? Gurudev, I see your lotus feet. The tree, the bird. Okay, thank you, Siddhan. All right, next. What do you see? Gurudev, I see you. Yes, they're all answering like this. And then finally, you know, one of them says, I just see the tree and the bird. Excellent. Sit down. Okay, you next. I only see the bird, Gurudev. Arjuna, what do you see? Gurudev, I only see the eye of the bird. So Arjuna had this kind of one-pointed focus that he only saw the eye of the bird. And yet Krishna says to him, Ma anusmam yujachal. Just imagine. He didn't have splayed intelligence. And he said, Ma anusmam yujachal. How do you see the eye of the bird and always see of Krishna? But Krishna was telling him to do that. And this means, my dear friends, in our own life, I don't think generally we're trying to kill others and they're trying to kill us. That's pretty intense concentration. But whatever we have to do, we can also remember Krishna. Now, the way that we also always remember Krishna is not the mechanical form of Astanga Yoga or Dhyan Yoga. The way we always remember Krishna is something that we all know how to do. Anything that we're anyone or anything that we're attached to, we will think about no matter how busy or how focused we have to be, isn't it? Yes? I remember before my daughter got married, before she had met her husband, they had been introduced long distance by a mutual friend, and so they were writing and chatting on the computer and talking on the phone. And he was going to come visit us in 3 weeks. So for those 3 weeks, she said all she thought about was him. So she was a Gurukul teacher, and she said, Mati, even when I'm teaching math or science or something that really engages my mind, she said, I'm only thinking about him. With a baby, you know, any of you who are parents, when the baby's newborn, you know, you can't even go in the next room, right? I remember when my youngest son and his wife had their first baby, and I was helping them. So I put him down to sleep, and then I walked out of the room, and my daughter-in-law says, how can you leave the baby in the room? I said, it's sleeping. You're waking up at night and you're saying, you know, is my baby breathing? Is my baby breathing? We're even like this with machines. You get a new car, you get a new computer, and there you are at work doing your job, and you're also thinking about your car. So this is Mama Nusram Yujachar. We are supposed to be in the samadhi of love. And Krishna says, Bhagavad Gita 7.1, a verse that Prabhupada quoted a lot, Maya Shaktamana Partha. Always think of me with attachment. Next point is to get a real experience. So to desire to please Krishna, to be absorbed in Krishna, and get an actual experience. Unless we get a taste of something better, we can't give up the inferior thing. Pratyaksha bhagavam dharmam susukam kartamamyam. We have to experience it. Unless we experience the spiritual happiness of uniting the Lord in His pleasure energy, we're going to go for the inferior happiness of trying to enjoy that energy ourselves. Because we're pleasure seeking. Yes? We can't stop it. We have to get a higher experience. Alright, I know a lot of you are thinking, I try that. I do. I try to please Krishna. I try to be absorbed in Krishna. I try to have spiritual experience, but I'm still bothered by sexual desire. And Prabhupada tells us that it's gradual. Right? He says gradually and progressively. It's interesting, there are other places where Prabhupada will say that immediately. Right? But here he's saying, don't abruptly try to cleanse your heart. You'll have to do it gradually. So what are we going to do? You know, I think of it like if you have a piece of cloth, right, and you put one end into water, and by osmosis, you all remember what that is, right, from your science classes? from osmosis. I'm so sorry, I was a teacher for too long, you know, I just can't help it. So by osmosis, the water's coming in one end of the cloth, and it's gradually going to make the whole cloth wet, right? So that's what's basically happening. When we're in Krishna consciousness, our material lust is gradually transforming back into spiritual love. So some part of it has already transformed, but some part of it hasn't. It's like it's partially transformed. Everybody understands? Yes? Some part of it's wet, some part of it's still dry. So what are we going to do with the part of our desire for happiness that hasn't yet been transformed back into love? It's like we have partial love and partial lust. This is very nicely explained, by the way, in the Madhurya Kadambini of Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur. And he talks about how in each stage of bhakti, we have a certain percentage of absorption in our own pleasure and absorption in Krishna's pleasure. So now you start out with total absorption in our own pleasure and just this little dot of absorption in Krishna's pleasure. And gradually, as we get more and more absorbed in Krishna's pleasure, our absorption in our own pleasure decreases, as Prabhupada says, gradually and proportionally. And Prabhupada says when we get to halfway, then we no longer have a hard struggle with determination. Everything comes very easy. Isn't that great? You don't have to wait till you're all the way there, just halfway. But what do we do, you know, when our spiritual taste is small and we still have a lot of this material taste? What do we do with it? We have to do something with it because we can't... What? Can't kill it, remember? Can't kill it. If you try to kill it, remember what happens? You get what? What are the three things that can happen? Anger or hard-heartedness or fall down. Okay, so turning lust back into love, we've got to use the part of it that hasn't transformed yet while it's transforming. So what are we going to do? We're going to look at two ways of using it. These are two broad general categories. There are subcategories within this. First, we're going to talk about the principle. We're going to talk about the principle. So we have this part of our pleasure seeking that's still selfish, that hasn't been transformed back into love. What are we going to do with it? Very important verse by Narada Muni. He said, "Does not a thing, when applied therapeutically, cure a disease that was caused by that very same thing?"
This is the essence of Krishna consciousness movement. The milk is the cause of a dysentery, but the same milk, when it is medically treated, can cure.
So Krishna's done something very kind. This is from 268. It's explained that it's Krishna's grace that our material sexual activities are pleasurable. And Prabhupada says here in this purport that the material pleasure of sex is a reality because it originates from the body of the Lord. Now, please think about this for a moment, okay? You have a guest in your house and you're buying them all kinds of things because they're in your house. Or they're a family member and so you're getting them things. And then they steal your money. Would you want them to enjoy that stolen money? No. Krishna lets us take pleasure in the stolen money. Please try to understand this point. Krishna is not envious. It's all right then, I'm going to go a little longer. Is that okay? So this is something really amazing about Krishna. We're trying to take away Radharani, Sita, Lakshmi from Krishna and enjoy her independently. And he's saying, okay, that's not going to work very well. You're going to lose the infinite pleasure that you found by enjoying through me, but I'm still going to let you have pleasure in it. That's amazing, isn't it? Krishna has no envy. But Krishna is also very smart. He says, okay, you'll be able to get pleasure in this, but I'm going to link it to reproduction. Now, I don't know, I'm a very curious person, and so I always wondered, why is there a link between sex and reproduction? Why? Why do you have to get babies that way? I mean, didn't have to be like that. Vishwamitra Muni made babies grow on trees. So why did Krishna do this? Why did Krishna say, okay, you want to steal my pleasure energy, you want to enjoy it on your own. Okay, you can enjoy it, but it's going to create children. Because Krishna is so smart. Children require a lot of responsibility. Which is why in the modern age, nobody wants them. When you have children, it means responsibility. When there's responsibility, there's something called yajna. If we don't break the natural biological link between sex and children, then sex becomes linked with yajna. In the modern society, people are trying to the best of their ability in many different ways to break this natural biological link between sex and babies. Am I correct? Gotta be correct, because if I wasn't correct, most people would be having 6 to 20 children. What kind of sacrifice? When you keep the link between sex and babies, you basically have two main choices for sacrifice: celibacy or marriage. Now, what's so important about sacrifice? Wonderful verse in the Bhagavad Gita, 3:15. Sarvagatam brahma nitya yajna pratisthitam. The all-pervading transcendence is eternally situated in acts of sacrifice. If we want to find God, where is God? God is everywhere. Sarvagatam. How will you find Him? Whenever you're doing sacrifice, there you will find God. How is that? Sacrifice seems to be giving up some pleasure. It seems like pain, and God is full of bliss. But what is God's bliss? God's bliss is a bliss of love. How do you know somebody loves you? They sacrifice for you. Isn't that a fact? I had a friend, she said, Urmila, you know, anytime you need me, I'm there for you. And one time I called her up, I said, I have a doctor's appointment in an hour, my car just died, can you drive me? She said, oh, it's my day off, I'm really just kind of taking it easy. That's not love. You know, how do you know someone loves you? They'll sacrifice for you. How do you know you love someone? You're willing to sacrifice for them. Therefore, God Himself, the supreme embodiment of bliss, is found in sacrifice. So Krishna's so smart. He said, oh, you want to take my pleasure, energy, and enjoy it independently. Look, that's not going to work out very well. You're not going to be happy with that. It's going to give you a little bit of temporary pleasure. I'll give you that. I'll put some pleasure in it. All right, there you go. But listen, I'm going to take this very thing that's caused your whole material entanglement, and I'm going to link it with sacrifice. Because if you link it with sacrifice, Krishna's thinking, you will find me. Because the Lord is always there in sacrifice. What is sacrifice? Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita 9:16, He is the butter and the fire and the offering of sacrifice. He is the butter and the fire of sacrifice. This is a very nice verse, 4:24, that when we offer everything, the butter, the fire, the sacrifice, in proper consciousness, everything becomes transcendental. Prabhupada says, matter dovetailed for the cause of the absolute truth regains its spiritual quality. Krishna consciousness is the process of converting the illusory consciousness into Brahman, or the Supreme. So we're going to take this part of our sexuality that's still lost, we're going to turn it into a sacrifice. By doing that, we spiritualize it. So what is this sexual energy? What are we talking about? So we could analyze it. It's about connection, which is yoga. It's about pleasure, which is Ananda. It's about creation, which is Kriya Shakti. It's about life, right? And it's about vitality or energy. And we have this nice verse, if somebody doubts that it's about vitality, in 3:26:32, Prabhupada translates virya as the sexual energy. All right, so we're going to take those energies, connection, pleasure, life, vitality, creativity. That's what sexual energy is. Everybody understand? Yes? That's what it is. And we're going to turn it to something useful for us by using it in sacrifice. And so we have two ways to do this. Now we're going to look specifically at those two ways. The first way, you may be surprised, is in renounced life. How does one turn the sexual energy into yajna in renounced life? People often think that renunciates have killed their sexual energy. Could that be true? Could that be true? No. Or you might think that a renunciate has fully turned all that lust back into love. Do you think that's true for all renunciates? That they're all completely pure? So renunciates must have some lust that's not transformed back into love yet. What are they going to do with it? Looking at Ayurveda, so we see that the reproductive, the biological reproductive energy is the last dhatu that is formed. And this nourishes the physical body, the heart, and the intellect, as Srila Prabhupada also explained. So this is an Ayurvedic principle that our reproductive fluids are the essence of our digestive process. By the way, such is true also with plants. This is why the majority of the world has their staple foods of seeds. Right? The vast majority of the world has as their staple food what? Wheat and rice are the two main staple foods of the world. What part of the plant is that? That's the reproductive part of the plant, isn't it? It's the seeds. And that's because the energy is concentrated there. So the idea in renounced life is that the renunciate takes this concentrated physical energy and brings it up to the brain. They're not killing it. They're bringing it up to the brain. Now, in the traditional yoga, they would do this very literally and physically. But one can also do it figuratively. In other words, one can work on mental and intellectual creativity and union and life and pleasure. The renunciate is supposed to take this butter and fire, the ghee and the fire, and supposed to internalize it. The Bhagavatam says the vanaprastha is supposed to wear fire-colored clothes. If you ever wondered why our renunciates wear the colored clothes that they wear, that is because they are supposed to be a walking sacrifice. In Bhagavatam 11.18.13, the sannyasi is supposed to put the sacrificial fire inside themselves. So the renunciate takes butter into the fire of sacrifice. When you put butter into the fire, it becomes ghee. Krishna says, I am the butter and the fire of sacrifice. So the renunciate, they themselves are the fire of sacrifice. They're taking this butter of their remaining lust and they're putting it into the fire of their own self, bringing it upwards. What is the ghee that they produce? What is the ghee of the renounced orders that is produced from this butter and fire? In this purport to 1841, Prabhupada says, a pure devotee cuts off the limited ties of affection for his family and widens his activities of devotional service for all forgotten souls. To cut off all family affection means to broaden the field of activities. Such an important point. People think renunciation means to cut, to kill, to harden. No, it means to broaden, to open. The renunciate takes this butter in the sacrifice of their own body. They bring it up to the brain. They bring it up to the heart. And they open their heart to all of humanity. They make all of humanity their responsibility. They're not just going to be responsible for one child, two children, even 20 children. They're going to be responsible for the world. We're saying Advaitacharya cared about the whole world. They're going to be responsible for teaching spiritual subjects to the whole world, writing books, helping everyone in the world come to their higher consciousness. In this way, they're going to use those energies of connection, of pleasure, of creativity, of life, and of vitality in the service of the Lord. Now, most people are not able to take that path from the beginning for their whole life. For the vast majority of people, that they've just got too much of their material lust in order to just engage it in this way. So people generally have to use the option of married life. So again, this is connecting one's sexuality with sacrifice, with responsibility. As Krishna says, the regulated householder sacrifice the objects of the senses in the fire of the senses. So the renunciate is putting the butter into the fire within him or herself and bringing it up and using it for mankind. The householder is bringing it down into the world. And Prabhupada says here that Krishna says, who's following the regulative principles, even in sex life, they can see Krishna. When the householders use sex and sacrifice, they experience the Lord in their sexual relations. That's amazing, isn't it? That's amazing philosophy we have in the Bhagavad Gita. Prabhupada says, so therefore Krishna says, when there is sexual intercourse according to the scriptural injunction, that is, I am. Krishna says, I am that sexual intercourse. In such kind of sexual intercourse, there is no sin. That is another yajna, just like we eat Krishna prasadam by offering yajna. Yajna shastashina santom vachante sarva kilbisha. So just like we eat prasadam by offering it in yajna. So the householders can enjoy gross sexual pleasure by offering that pleasure in yajna to the Lord. That's not just physical, it's also emotional. Prabhupada says the reciprocation of service and love between husband and wife is the ideal of householder's life. Sometimes devotees think, you know, well, oh, this affection is all mine. If we use it as yajna, if we use it to please the Lord, then we will see Krishna in that and it will act to spiritually elevate us. Now, we talked about the butter and the fire of sacrifice and the renunciate. Srila Prabhupada often compares women to a fire and man to a butter. Yes, you've heard this? Right? So if we just think about this, who's more attracted to whom? Are men more attracted to women or women more attracted to men? We all know that men are much more attracted to women than women are attracted to men. Everybody knows that. That's not any kind of a secret. Have you ever wondered about why? Again, I'm just a really curious person. Somebody's wondered about why. Well, if you keep this link between sex and reproduction, if you don't break the link, who's going to bear the main burden for reproduction? The men or the women? The women, duh. So Krishna has arranged that when a soul is in a woman's body, that the woman has a much greater capacity to say no than a man does. Have you all noticed this? Yes, I'm sure you have. There's one devotee who did a comedy skit in New Vrindavan, and he said, I think men are less intelligent. He said, because women are only going to be attracted to a man who has at least some opulence. He's got to have some beauty, some wealth, some fame, some, you know. He says, but a man's attracted to a woman if she's three-dimensional. He says, or even maybe two-dimensional. So the women, we have a capacity, when the soul's in a female body, we have a capacity to say no. We're not so easily attracted. And we say, I don't know. Are you going to be a good husband and father? Yes, yes, yes. I don't know. You've got to marry me first. See, when you don't break this link, then the woman's going to say, you've got to marry me first. You understand? In our modern society, through, you know, different devices and chemicals and procedures, we've broken this link, so now the women don't say that anymore. They just say, okay, whatever you want. But if you keep the way that Krishna's arranged things, the women will say, marriage. First marriage. Right? And she has a woman has the ability to do that. And the man's like, okay, whatever you want. Because his attraction is so strong. And then what happens? The man is pushed to dharma. There's a lot of interesting studies that if you want to civilize society, if you want to stop crime, if you want to stop vandalism, get people married. Sorry to be totally revolutionary about this. When men are married, they're civilized. If they just have a girlfriend, they're not civilized. That doesn't work. Just have a girlfriend doesn't do it. If a man's married, he becomes civilized. Prabhupada talks about this. He talks about that in India. When he was growing up, the employers would always prefer to hire married men because they'd be a lot more responsible. Come on, we all know that the biggest problem with crime and unrest and difficulty in any society is young unmarried males. Yes? Is this some sort of a secret in the world? I don't care whether you're in South Africa or you're in China or wherever you are. It's young unmarried males that aren't using this energy properly. Yes? They've got this energy and it's not being used in yajna. So what happens when you have a yajna? The yajna is like a pot. If the man's like butter and the woman's like fire, if you put the butter in a pot, the pot is marriage. And then you're going to have ghee in your pot. If you just stick the butter on fire, you're going to have a mess. Yes? If you put the butter in the pot on fire, you're going to have ghee. So we talked about what is the ghee of the renounced order. Well, what's the ghee of marriage? What's the ghee of marriage, everybody? Children! Aww. Children are so unpopular today. I don't know what it is. Well, I know. I know exactly what it is. Why are children unpopular? Because people want to get the pleasure that Krishna's put into sexuality without the yajna. By the way, what happens when you try to take the pleasure without the yajna? What mode do you become in? Anybody know what mode of nature, goodness, passion, or ignorance? Ignorance. Now, the love we have for children shouldn't be just material affection. Then we're just like dogs and cats and whatever. But it should be, as Prabhupada explains in Kunti's prayer about material love for family, it should be the relationship of the soul to soul via the super soul. Our love for our children should be a relationship of soul to soul via the super soul. Now, another ghee of married life is the reciprocation of love between the husband and the wife. Let's imagine for a moment. Let's imagine that all people of marriageable age in the world who are not living as renunciates were married and loved each other. Can we imagine that for a minute? Imagine if everyone in the world between the ages of like 18 and 50 or 60 who were not renunciates were married and loved their spouse. What do you think would happen to the world? What do you think? It would be an amazing place. Do you think most of our social, political issues would be gone? You'd be right. So this is part of the ghee of married life, is having a sweet emotional relationship of a reciprocation of service and love. This is from Bhagavatam 3.23.1. And another part of the ghee of married life is fortune, prosperity. Because when you have a spouse and you have children, you have to maintain them. Yes? And then this is going to lead to responsible work, responsible vocation that again gives charity to the renunciates, charity in society in general, and we have a society of prosperity. So the ghee of married life is children that we relate to soul to soul via the super soul, the emotional sweetness and good fortune. So those analogies are from the Shastra. I'm going to give you my own analogy. So if you don't like it, that's fine. It's just my personal analogy. So if you break a bone, the cure for breaking a bone is you have to have a plaster on it, right? You have to have a cast. The bone in its original form is wonderful, right? It's great. But a broken bone is painful. So our original bone would be like the Adivasa, our original relationship with Krishna, the original way we experience divine, spiritual, sexual pleasure. A broken bone is like that love which has been turned into lust. The plaster, the cast, is like the process of bhakti that sets that bone back in the right place. But those of you who are medical practitioners, you'll know that when a person has some kind of great pain, all the muscles get tense. And when they get tense, the blood doesn't flow very well. and healing is impeded. And so therefore, when a person has some sort of severe fracture, they'll often give painkillers also. Do painkillers cure the broken bone? No. In fact, if you just took painkillers and you didn't use a cast, would your bone get better or worse? A lot worse, because you wouldn't feel the pain and you'd injure it even further. But while you're waiting for the acute pain to subside, it's useful to have painkillers. In the beginning, it's useful to have some painkillers. And once the bone starts to heal, you don't need them anymore. You just rely on the cast. So the good bone is like our original spiritual relationship. The broken bone is like our lust. The cast is like bhakti. The painkillers are either marriage or renunciation. And you've got to decide, okay, according to my nature. Because, you know, some people are allergic to some kinds of medicine. Some people are allergic to the painkiller of grihastha life, and they have to take the painkiller of renounced life. And some people are allergic to the painkiller of renounced life, and they have to take the painkiller of grihastha. Okay, just to summarize, the desire for pleasure is part of the soul. Sexual energy and desire are inherent both in the spiritual form of Krishna and the living entities. Our spiritual sexual satisfaction comes in uniting Krishna and his pleasure and energy. If we try to kill that desire for pleasure, first of all, we will not succeed. All we'll do is transmute it into anger, or we'll become callous, or we'll have a fall down. To turn love into lust, love turns into lust when we take that spiritual energy and we try to use it for ourselves. We misuse our independence, and then it comes out in a twisted, impure manner through our body. We turn lust back into love. The real cure is we take pleasure in uniting the Lord and his pleasure energy by chanting Hare Krishna, by serving Lord Chaitanya's mission. And in the meantime, we have to engage our sexuality in a sacrifice with butter on fire making ghee. We can take the ghee of renounced life, putting the sacrificial fire in our own body, expanding the family through preaching, doing creative, connecting pleasure energy in study, meditation, and the mission. Or we can do the butter on the fire making ghee in household life, in the pot of family life, instead of within our own body, as expanding the family through our children, and creative connecting pleasure energy in offering our occupation to the Lord. So I hope you enjoyed this presentation. Sorry that we went a little long. Do I have 5 minutes time to show one video about the Dham? So this philosophy is just wonderful. Oh, we have some questions? Oh, okay. Are we all right with time, though? Or are you really going to kill me with the time? We only have one question here. At the time of death, who leaves the body first, the spirit soul or the super soul? Oh, that's such a nice question. The spirit soul is not divided. The super soul is not divided. The super soul is situated as one. It's just like there's a sun in the sky, and that sun is shining on everybody's head, but there's only one sun. So there's only one super soul. It's not that we each have our own super soul. So that was a very nice question. So what do you think of this philosophy that Srila Prabhupada's taught us about sexuality? Is it amazing or what? Anything? Pretty amazing, huh? I mean, you know, we respect and love all genuine spiritual traditions, but I'll tell you, are there many of them that are going to teach at this depth of understanding and practice something really amazing? Okay, I have something that I would like to show you.